I'll get started. I rushed at the end last time and felt I did a crappy job of explaining the structure of the spontaneous symmetry breaking in the Sander model. So, just to get the logic clear, I just wanted to recap here before going on. So, here is our famous table. You know, this is the table that specifies the gauge group and representation for the standard model. And we saw that if you took this table and wrote down the actual Yang-Mills Lagrangian for it, you get this Lagrangian for the standard model. So now we want to understand the structure of symmetry breaking as follows. So, you know, the top two lines there are the bosonic terms in the standard model. There's no fermions up there, no spinner fields. The bottom two lines are the fermionic terms. So let's understand those separately. So let's first, it's sort of helpful to see first what happens to the bosonic terms in the Lagrangian and what the physics of that, what spontaneous symmetry breaking does there, and then the analogous thing for the fermionic terms. So the rapid resummation of what happens, summary of what happens in the bosonic sector is this. The logical structure is the following. The full Lagrangian has Lie algebra SU3 times SU2 times U1. So that's an 8 plus 3 plus 1 equals 12 dimensional Lagrangian. Remember, SUN, you may or may not know this, but it's traceless Hermitian matrices or traceless anti-Hermitian matrices. Anyway, either way, SUN has dimension n squared minus 1. So SU3 has dimension 8, et cetera. Okay, but then we said, well, there's only this four-dimensional subalgebra that acts non-trivially on H, the subalgebra spanned by these four generators, the hypercharge Y and the three generators of SU2. But within that, there's a subalgebra that annihilates the VEV. So the VEV, I should say plus capital H here. Sorry, I'll get back to this in 1 second. But yeah, so by the VEV here, again, I mean the vector 1 over root 2 times 0v. So again, last time we saw that this combination of these generators annihilates that guy. And so the result of that is that, one way to say it is that if this had been a global symmetry that we were breaking, a theory without gauge fields, then the story would be the following, that we would have, you know, H is this doublet of complex, it has two complex fields. It's a two-component vector with two complex fields, so four real components. And under such a spontaneous symmetry breaking, it would break into three Goldstone bosons, in other words, three massless scalar fields, and one Higgs boson, one actual massive scalar field. In other words, if we take this vector space quotiented by this one, the dimension of the quotient space, so the quotient space is three-dimensional, the Goldstone bosons correspond to those, the three Goldstone bosons correspond to the three dimensions of that quotient space. Another way to say it pictorially, again, is they parameterize moving around the three-sphere, the vacuum manifold of the Higgs potential. And then, however many real components we had to start with, n minus 3 would be the number of massive bosons we have. Well, in practice here we have 1 left over because we started with 4. And then for the gauge bosons, there's an analogous thing which happens, which is that the three generators corresponding to the quotient space, the three generators that correspond to motion along the sphere, they get broken. They don't leave the Higgs-Bev invariant. And then what happens to them is they each eat one of the Goldstone bosons and become massive by the famous so-called Higgs mechanism. And they become these three massive vector bosons, a neutral one, Z mu, and then two more with charge plus and minus one, the W bosons. And then the remaining generator, which corresponds to the charge, the remaining gauge boson, which corresponds to the charge, the generator that annihilates the vacuum, that's the photon, okay? And so just to say that slightly more, just to try to do a better job of saying explicitly, more explicitly what happens. Where is the, oh, that is there. So next to the table here, I have the what the substitutions are, how after spontaneous symmetry breaking happens, you go before spontaneous symmetry breaking, the convenient variables to use are the ones in this table. But after spontaneous symmetry breaking, you make a change of variables. So you replace those four gauge bosons, W mu 1, W mu 2, say W mu 3, and B mu. Okay, you replace these four gauge bosons, you remove those and write the Lagrangian instead in terms of these four gauge bosons, W mu plus minus Z mu and A mu. You replace these two left-handed lepton doublets you split them into four left-handed fields. And then the Higgs, you make this substitution, you replace the Higgs doublet H by constant, the vacuum expectation value, plus a single real scalar field. This is in so-called unitary gauge, where the only non-zero part of the Higgs is in the bottom component and is real. And then we had this way that the Higgs appears in this other form in the Lagrangian, where you take its complex conjugate and multiply by I sigma 2. And so that just moves that whole expression from the bottom component to the top component. Okay, now the point is that if we just take our Lagrangian, so now to understand the physics of spontaneous symmetry breaking, we follow a common strategy used all over in physics, which is that you split your Lagrangian or your Hamiltonian into a free part, in other words, a part that is quadratic in the fields, and everything else, the interaction terms, which are higher than cubic or higher in the fields. And so we're going to do that here. So imagine we took just the quadratic part, all the quadratic terms in this Lagrangian. So for example, in G mu nu here, normally there's a partial mu G nu, that's okay. And there's a partial nu G mu, that's okay. But then there's a commutator of G mu and G nu. We'll throw that away because that'll always hit something here and give something higher than quadratic. So anyway, we keep just the quadratic terms, and we make these substitutions. And what we find, the point is, those substitutions are chosen because, the game always is, you split the Lagrangian into the free part and the interactions, and then you look at the free part and you diagonalize. And once you've diagonalized it, you can read off from the free part of the Lagrangian what the degrees of freedom of the theory are in the theory and what their properties are, what are their masses and charges, etc. So in particular, it's an exercise is to check that Well, it turns out the relevant terms in the bosonic part of the Lagrangian, the parts that get changed, are, if we just look at this term, and this term, and the kinetic term for the Higgs. Okay, and we make this change of variables. We switch to the new gauge bosons W mu plus minus Z and A mu, and we also replace the Higgs by its VeV. So we'll drop all the H terms. We're just trying to get the quadratic part for the gauge bosons here. Then, I actually take that back. So this becomes minus 1/4 W mu nu A, W mu nu A, where now A is only runs over the first two terms. A only runs over one, the first two generators, A equals 1 and 2, and minus 1/2 MW squared times W mu A, W mu A. I should say this whole term now runs over only A equals 1, 2, and MW is given by 1/2 times the gauge coupling constant G2 times the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. Okay, so we get that term, and then we get another term, which is minus 1/4 Z mu nu, minus 1/2 mz squared z mu, okay, where mz is given by 1/2 square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared times the Higgs VeV. And then finally, minus 1/4 F mu nu, where this again is just the normal electromagnetic field strength built from the photon A mu. And I should say Z mu nu is also the exactly analogous field strength built from Z mu. Okay, so in other words, this is the Lagrangian now for a pair of real massive vector bosons, which we can group together into a complex vector boson, W mu plus minus. But anyway, for simplicity, for comparing, I just left it this way, just because it's really the first two terms just go along for the ride here. So those are the two W bosons, and then there's this is the Lagrangian for another massive vector boson with a different mass, the Z boson, and then the Lagrangian for the photon, you notice, has no mass term here. It's just massless. Okay, so that's just, you know, if you've never done it, you should do it. Just to check that those two terms under that change of variable diagonalizes in that way. So those are the physical bosons, vector bosons after spontaneous symmetry breaking. And now, let's and where theta W, I didn't summarize it again, but just to have that written down somewhere. Theta W again, we work in the G2, G1 plane. The coupling is at some value, G1, U2. That's backwards. theta W is this angle here. Okay, so much for the bosonic sector. Let's just do the fermionic sector now. And then begin to discuss neutrinos. Okay, so what happens if we substitute, if we just focus on the quadratic terms in the fermionic Lagrangian and make and substitute the Higgs bev here? Okay, so since we're focusing on the quadratic terms, the capital D slashes become partial slashes because all the gauge fields give cubic terms. I mean, the gauge fields, whenever you include a gauge field in the covariant derivative, you get two fermions and a gauge field. So that's an interaction term, so we'll let those go. So focusing on the quadratic terms, the kinetic term becomes U left bar partial slash U left plus D left bar partial slash D left. In other words, I just plugged in Q left in terms of U left and D left. And once again, still the right-handed guys. U right slash U right plus D right partial slash D right. Then, similarly, when I plug in for L left here, in that term, I'll get two terms. I'll get new left bar partial slash new left plus E left bar partial slash E left. And then I just have one more term, which is the E right term. E right bar partial slash E right. Okay. So that's what the kinetic term becomes. And then the Yukawa term, well, if I plug in U left, D left here, but that two component vector is contracted, that SU, that's two components in SU2 space. It's contracted with the SU, it's contracted with this two component vector, which is also two components in SU2 space. Okay, but we're putting in the VEV for H because we're trying to find the quadratic terms. So H we're just going to replace by 1/2, by 1 over root 2, 0V. So since it's 0V, it selects out the bottom component of this vector, the D left term, and the U left term drops out. Okay, so this becomes D left bar VCKM YD. Okay, I'm going to rewrite YD as MD, and I'll explain what that is in 1 second, times D right. Okay, where MD I've just defined to be, I used to have a little Y sub D there, a diagonal real matrix. Now from the Higgs VEV, I got this constant factor of V over the square root of 2. I'm just going to absorb that in so that now instead of being a dimensionless matrix Y, I'm going to have a matrix with the units of mass, which is the down quark mass matrix. So in other words, this is just V over root 2 times my old matrix little Y sub D. And then anyway, the next term. Now in this term, because we have H twiddle, you know, if you just work it out, I sigma 2 times this expression for the VEV gives this expression for the VEV. It moves the VEV up. So instead of selecting down left when it contracts with Q left bar, I'll select up left in this next term. So from this term, I get U left bar M sub U right. Or again, M sub U is the same as over here. I'm gonna define it to be the mass matrix that's proportional to the Yukawa coupling that I previously had. Powell matrix. And then finally, here we have H again, so it will select the lower component of this, which is E left. So we'll have E left bar contracted with times the matrix ME times E right, where ME is the electron mass matrix. Again, it's just V over root 2 times Y sub E, and then plus the Hermitian conjugate here. And so now, but this, you notice this all will now simplify. Let me do two things. So, okay. So this term and this term already look like a normal mass matrix. They already look like they're supposed to. In other words, these guys are already diagonal. Over here, we have this extra unitary matrix sitting in here, making this thing not look like a diagonal set of mass matrices yet. So what we want to do is absorb this guy. We want to redefine DL prime to be that whole thing. Okay, and so now, so we replace DL by DL prime, DL times VCKM by DL prime here, but then we can also, at no charge, rewrite this thing. So we can just rewrite this thing as DL prime bar, but then we can also just rewrite this thing as DL prime bar, because we would get a VCKM appearing here, a VCKM dagger appearing here. Those guys would cancel, and so we can just replace that whole thing by DL prime, and there also. And now we see that if we define the Dirac spinners, so if we take the D left and D right components and put them together, so if we combine D right, which remember is only the upper two components of a Dirac spinner, with D left. What am I doing? What I meant to say is, if we define the Dirac spinner D to be D right and D left prime, and then we define the Dirac spinner U to be U right and U left, and the Dirac spinner E to be E right and E left, then this expression simplifies. It becomes just, the kinetic term just becomes I U bar partial slash U plus D bar partial slash D plus E bar partial slash E. And then plus, well, what we haven't been able to absorb is this. This guy is still by itself, so plus new left bar partial slash new left. And then the Yukawa terms simply become U bar mu u plus D bar m d d plus E bar M E E. Okay, in other words, this term, U left and U right, plus its complex conjugate, its Hermitian conjugate would be U R bar times M U times U left. Those things together are just this term, U bar M U U. D left prime M D D R plus its complex conjugate again, and it just becomes this D bar MDD and et cetera, and same thing for the electron. Okay, so so now, in other words, the free part of the Lagrangian has now been, of the fermion Lagrangian has now been diagonalized, and we can see what the degrees of freedom are. There, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, there are three up-type quarks, which are Dirac spinners, not chiral spinners. They have masses which are the eigenvalues of these three matrices. Of the three eigenvalues of this matrix. So those are really the up charm and top quark. The D quark is also a Dirac spinner, and it comes in three families, which have masses which are the eigenvalues of this matrix. The E is also a Dirac spinner with eigenvalues in this family. And then the neutrino is still a Weyl spinner. It's still just a two-component left chiral spinner. And it is massless. Okay, we have no corresponding mass term for it. Okay. Now, let's maybe notice one more thing. Let's notice a couple physical things about the fermion Lagrangian that are important. So, first of all, we got to this Lagrangian by plugging in this expression into the fermion terms there. But we only kept the V part. So we got all these mass terms by just plugging in this expression and keeping V. But we could have done the opposite thing. There's also the term, when we're doing our change of variables, there's also the other term where we just plug in H. And so we also have those in the standard model Lagrangian where here, basically it's the same Lagrangian. Yeah, if you instead had plugged in the other part of the Higgs doublet here, the capital H part, then instead of mu in this term, you would still have the Yukawa coupling matrix yu times h. Here you would have yd times h. Here you would have ye times h. So in other words, and those terms, instead of being mass terms for the fermions, represent their Yukawa couplings to the Higgs. So there's a prediction in the standard model, which is that the masses of the quarks, the masses of all the different fermions are proportional to their Yukawa couplings to the Higgs. So in other words, when you measure the mass of the up quark and the mass of the, when you measure the mass of the top quark, let's say, and the bottom quark, and then alternatively, you produce a Higgs boson at CERN, and it decays sometimes into an up quark, sometimes into a top quark, and sometimes into a bottom quark. You know, the ratio of the masses of those two quarks squared should be proportional to the ratio of the decay rates into those two channels. So anyway, that's one key point. Prediction about the, which, you know, that's a thing which any beyond the standard model has to either, so that has been tested now experimentally to some extent by CERN, and that's something that any beyond the standard model physics either can't screw up or can't screw up too much. And then there's a second point which I wanted to make was that, you know, this fact that we had to do a change of basis from DL to DL prime to diagonalize the mass is saying something important about the quark sector of the standard model, which is that the so-called weak eigenbasis, which are the three down-type quarks that we originally started with, are different than the mass eigenbasis, which are the three down-type quarks with a prime. So, in terms of physics, again, the point of one of the key points of having a Lagrangian like this is that you can read off all of the Feynman diagrams that contain the sort of perturbative scattering physics of this Lagrangian. So far we took the quadratic terms and we studied those and we threw away the interaction terms. So for a moment, let's do the opposite. Let's think about the interaction terms. Then, you know, an example of an interaction term for the involving the down-type quark, the left-handed down-type quark is the term involving the gauge boson here. So in other words, there's a term like if we take the QL bar Q term in the kinetic term, then that looks like UL bar DL bar, and then there's the derivative, and then there's various connection terms here, but let's focus on the one that rotates in this SU2, acts on the SU2 index, which is this two-component index we're displaying here. So that's IG2 W mu A times the generators, which are the Pauli sigma matrices, two. And then we have this big, then we have Q left over here. So U left, D left. So what you see here is that, you know, if you look for an interaction term here, there's cubic terms that involve a fermion coupling to a W boson, one of these bosons, and then coupling to another fermion here. And so in particular, there's a diagram in the standard model where, let's say, an up quark comes in and emits a W plus, and then a D left comes out. And because this Lagrangian was, the kinetic term was completely flavor diagonal. Remember, this family I only talked to the same family I over here. Because it was diagonal like that, that means when an up type quark of family I comes in, a down type quark of family I comes out. This is purely I type. But, you know, what we saw here is that down type I quark is not a mass eigenstate. In order instead to get a mass eigenstate, we have to switch to this basis. So our DL comes out here, but then it's actually some linear combination, VCKM, IJ times the actual mass eigenstates. Okay, so that's somehow the physical content of VCKM. That the fact that we couldn't remove it means that when W bosons generate transitions between different types of quarks, there's the weak eigenbasis in which you say if an up quark comes in, the weak eigenbasis tells you, you know, the weak eigenbasis for D tells you the basis vectors are the things that come out when an up or a charm or a top comes in. But when a pure weak eigenbasis vector comes out, you know, the point is that physically it is not a mass eigenstate. It's actually a linear combination of several different mass eigenstates, which will then oscillate in different ways as they move away from the point of creation. Okay. Oh, and then, you know, another thing to say is that if you think about it, so people say that the charged current in the standard model, by that I mean to say the stuff that talks to the W plus and W minus boson, the charged current interaction is flavor changing. Okay, meaning that if I have an up quark coming in, the mass eigenstate that I can get out is not necessarily a down quark. It can also be a charm or a top. Sorry, it's not necessarily a down. It can also be a bottom or a strange. So that's what people mean when they say that the flavor can change. If you again look at this same term in the Lagrangian, you think about, okay, what if this had been a W3 boson or a B mu boson being emitted? Or in the spontaneously broken language, what if this was a photon or a Z boson? Then because those generators, see, the W plus minus boson came from the W1 and W2 bosons here, which talk to the, which multiply the sigma 1 and sigma 2 Pauli matrices, which are off diagonal. So that's why they generate a coupling between the U left over here and the D left over here. So that's why they change the flavor. On the other hand, the neutral bosons here, they're proportional to either, well, B mu, we didn't write it down, but it's proportional to the identity matrix. W3 is proportional to sigma 3. So they're both diagonal matrices, so they only generate couplings between U left and U left, or between D left and D left. So people say that the neutral currents in the standard model are not flavor changing. Okay, so, or really strictly speaking, at tree level that's true. Actually, at loop level, it turns out you can write down flavor changing neutral currents in the standard model, but they're super suppressed. And so they haven't been observed yet. And so that's a key point. That's another prediction of the standard model. Flavor changing neutral currents are unobservably small. Normally, when you try to muck with the standard model and add any beyond the standard model physics to it, you mess that up. In particular, the MSSM always has to struggle with that, the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So there's very tight experimental bounds on this, and so that's a key constraint whenever you're trying to keep in mind whenever you're building some model of beyond the standard model physics. Okay, so that's it. That's really all. That summarizes, I believe, everything about the standard model. How to write down its Lagrangian, how to split it into the bosonic and fermionic pieces, look at the quadratic parts, understand the physical degrees of freedom obtained by diagonalizing the quadratic parts in the bosonic and fermionic sectors respectively, to know what the physical degrees of freedom are after spontaneous symmetry breaking, and like a couple key bits of phenomenology about what the interaction terms say. Once you know all that, you know the structure of the standard model quite well, I would say. And so it's time for, I think, celebratory Pez. I didn't hand out the Pez last time, and that I felt was a big problem with the last lecture. So I'm going to do that this time. Is it insulting that I hand out the Pez? Is this actually offensive to people, or is it not? Okay, so that's good. I was meaning to get maybe something different, but I didn't have a chance to yet. I'll try on the weekend. Meanwhile, time for me to have a sip of my tea. Does anyone know a good joke that is appropriate for our class? People are always embarrassed to tell their jokes.
What was the second story with your grandmother?
What was the second story with the grandmother? That's a good question. I'm trying to remember what I was thinking. I mean, there's lots of things I could say about my grandmother. I don't remember what I was going to say, but if you want. So another thing that I remember was that she used to have me. This was when I was rather littler than the previous story. I remember an activity that we did was that I would give her quote unquote hairdos, which was just me putting candy wrappers in her hair, and thought it was hilarious. That's it. Okay, so let's talk about neutrinos. I mean, so we have achieved a great victory in understanding everything there is to understand about the Standard Model, and so let's discuss now how the Standard Model does. And you know, the answer is that it does very well. Makes lots of experimental predictions, and they're essentially all correct. Many of them have been tested now, and they've essentially all been correct. So there's only three clear things that the Standard Model seems to not, the Standard Model we've just talked about, seems to not be able to account for. In other words, it's not just that we don't know how to explain these things. It's a bit of a stronger statement that if the Standard Model is correct, it seems incompatible with the following three things. Okay, one is that the Standard Model predicts that the neutrinos are all massless and that they don't oscillate. Experiment disagrees. Okay, second, there's no dark matter candidate in the Standard Model. We seem to need dark matter in cosmology. Maybe it'll turn out that there's some other explanation for what's going on, but if we need a particle to be the dark matter, that particle is not in the Standard Model. And then finally, the cosmological matter-antimatter asymmetry, the universe today, is observed to be made of almost entirely particles rather than antiparticles, that is, baryons and leptons, as opposed to, well, in any case, baryons as opposed to antibaryons. And now that we have measured the CKM matrix, and also the mass of the Higgs, it's clear that the Standard Model by itself does not account for this matter-antimatter asymmetry. Okay, and so what's going on? Well, you know, in writing down the Standard Model, we basically made two assumptions. Okay, assumption one was that we were only going to write down renormalizable terms. So assumption one was only terms with dimension less than or equal to 4. And then assumption two was that only the fields in that table, the fields in that table are the whole story, or everything. Only the fields in our table. That's all we can use to build our Lagrange. And by the way, a key point here, which I think I did not correctly identify on the table, although I'm sure you. So here I wrote this line in on the table, which I tend to do out of habit, but actually this particle, again, we did not include, right-handed neutrino, when we were writing down the Standard Model. Okay, so at least item one, and probably items two and three, indicate that one of these two assumptions is wrong. And so there's two commonly considered solutions to this, which involve either dropping assumption one or dropping assumption two. Okay, so let's talk about dropping assumption one first. We want to basically discuss those two solutions in turn. Okay, so solution, let's first describe the two solutions in brief. So solution one is that we give up assumption one, okay? So we still assume that the fields in our table are the only fields we have to work with, but now we're going to permit ourselves to write down, we're going to allow terms with dimension higher than four. Okay, so these are so-called non-renormalizable terms in the Lagrangian, and they, so the perspective here is really that the standard model is an effective field theory. That, in other words, really, there is other physics up at high energies. Other fields maybe and particles, but they're too heavy for us to produce and see directly at low energies. And so in practice, we can, for all intents and purposes, we can integrate them out of the Feynman path integral. But then they don't disappear completely. They still show up indirectly in the low energy Lagrangian for the fields that are in our table, but they show up through the fact that they induce that even if the initial theory was renormalizable when we integrated out those extra fields, the low energy theory involving just those fields will have non-renormalizable terms which reflect the indirect influence of the high dimensional of the massive fields we've integrated out on the low energy physics we actually see. So the leading, from that perspective, the leading effects of beyond the standard model physics should come from the leading non-renormalizable term. From the dimension 5 operators in the standard model. And it turns out there's just a unique dimension 5 operator in the standard model. And it does predict neutrino masses and neutrino oscillations. So we'll describe that more in a moment. But just to say that this solution, gives a very nice answer to the first puzzle above about neutrino masses and neutrino oscillations, but it doesn't help with the second. So only solves mystery one. Whereas solution two, let's talk about it briefly before explaining. I'll come back and explain solution one in more detail, but let's first talk about solution two briefly. So now we drop the other assumption. So we will still keep the first assumption. We'll continue to assume that the Lagrangian is renormalizable, but we'll drop the assumption that the only fields in the standard model are fields we originally used, and we'll, in particular, we'll include this extra field. So in each generation, we'll add a right-handed neutrino to be the partner of the left-handed neutrino. Just like every other left-handed field here has a partner field, and there's a certain pattern about how the field and its partner are related, so their electric charge is the same, et cetera. So there's a pattern that tells one exactly what the right-handed field should look like here, and we're going to add that term. So we'll add new right. So an important thing to say about this is that this first of all, is very nice from a theoretical standpoint. So it turns out that once you add the right-handed neutrino, before adding the right-handed neutrino, we have this hodgepodge of charges. Looks kind of weird-looking table. When you add the right-handed neutrino, it becomes possible to find a much neater group theoretic explanation for where those charges come from. We'll talk about next week. So from a theoretical standpoint, it's nice from a number of respects. But then also, this also explains mystery number one, masses and the fact that neutrinos have masses and oscillate. But it also gives a natural candidate explanation for mysteries number two and three. So it does more. And then when this right-handed neutrino is heavy, it's exactly one of those fields you can integrate out from low-energy physics we were discussing before up here. And so when you do integrate out the right-handed neutrino, you see you exactly recover solution one. New right is heavy. And we do expect new right to be heavy because when it is heavy, there's a couple reasons that I'll explain, but when it is heavy, most famously, it gives this nice seesaw mechanism explanation for why the observed neutrino masses that we do see are so light compared with all of the other masses in the standard model. Okay. Okay, so I guess I will only have time to begin solution one here. I'm not going to make the same mistake as yesterday of rushing and being incoherent. So to begin solution one, we want to write down the only dimension 5 term in the standard model. This is Weinberg famously observed 40 years ago that there was only one dimension 5 term. And so how do we see what it is? Well, for starters, it's helpful to know the following thing. So if you have psi, let's say psi is a spinner. So under a Lorentz transformation, it transforms in a certain way. Okay, which you may have met in a field theory class. But if you haven't and you want to know about it, just ask me afterwards and I'll tell you more about that. But the bottom line for now is that, so, you know, what if we take psi, what if we take its complex conjugate? Is that still, does that thing still transform like a spinner? We can build our Lagrangian out of. And the answer is no. Okay. Psi star does not transform like a spinner. But if we want to take the complex conjugate of a spinner and then turn it back into a spinner, a thing that transforms like our original spinner, we can define the charge conjugate spinner, which is we take our psi star and we multiply it. We just have to then do a change of basis. We multiply it by minus I gamma 2. And that thing now transforms exactly the same way that our original thing did. Okay. So and that's a unique transformation. Okay. Now, if psi was a left-handed spinner, so in other words, if we wrote it in four-component Dirac notation, if it had two zeros and then non-zero components on the bottom, then you can see because gamma 2 is an off-diagonal matrix. The charge conjugate of this, in other words, psi left c, again, I remind you, is minus I gamma 2, psi left star. this thing behaves like this thing is now a right chiral spinner. In other words, it has its non-zero components are the upper components and has zero in the lower components. So normally when we write down a mass term, if you want to write down a mass term or a Yukawa term, any term with two fermions and no Dirac operator, not a kinetic term, just two fermions undifferentiated. Normally we always have to couple, we have to write down something like this, psi r bar psi l, to get, this is Lorentz invariant and non-vanishing. If we tried to write down psi l bar psi l, that would vanish because there's a gamma zero in here that is off there. Okay, so that's the non-vanishing Lorentz invariant combination. Now, you might say, well, oh, but you just told me that psi left conjugate is a right chiral thing. So can I just write it? So instead of this, could I replace psi right here by psi left conjugate? And the answer is, yes, that is Lorentz invariant for the exact same reason that this is. This transforms exactly the same way as this does. But normally, it's not going to satisfy our gauge invariance constraint. We want this thing to be SU3 times SU2 times U1 invariant. Now, let's imagine that psi left and psi right had both transformed the same way under gauge transformations. So let imagine that psi left and psi right both transform the same way under gauge transformations. Let's say they're both a triplet under SU3 and have charge 1/2 or something. Then this term will be fine from a gauge invariant standpoint because the charge 1/2 here will be canceled by a charge minus 1/2 here because we took the complex conjugate here. And this thing will transform like a 3 under SU3, whereas this thing will transform like a 3 bar, again, because we took the complex conjugate. So the whole thing will be gauge invariant. Now here the problem is, if this thing transforms like a 3, well, here we took two complex conjugates. We took a first complex conjugate to define psi c, and we took a second one when we took the bar. So this thing also transforms like a 3. So this thing will the two indices will not annihilate each other, will not pair up correctly. Or similarly, if this has charge 1/2, instead of having charge minus 1/2, this has charge 1/2 again. So basically, if this thing varies, if this thing transforms under non-trivially under the gauge group, then this combination will be Lorentz invariant but won't be gauge invariant. The observation is just that there is actually an object that you can write down in the standard model, which is if you take H twiddle and L left, let's say you take H twiddle dagger and multiply that times L left. So in other words, L left is a two-component vector in SU2 sense. H twiddle is a two-component vector in SU2 sense. So you can take the dagger of one and dot it with the other one. So now this thing has no hanging indices except for a spinner index. The SU2 index of this got eaten. Only the spinner index is left over. If you think about it, this thing is gauge invariant now because this had SU2 charge 2 and U1 charge minus 1/2. This thing also had SU2 charge 2 and U1 charge minus 1/2. So when we took their dagger, those things just killed each other. So this is exactly the kind of spinner that we want. If we want to write down a term like this, this is a so-called Majorana mass term like this. It'll only be gauge invariant when the spinner we put in there is also gauge invariant. Well, here we have a gauge invariant thing that only has a spinner index, so we can write down a term like this. So that's the dimension 5 term in the standard model. Anyway, we'll talk about the physics of it next time. I apologize for running a little bit over. Any questions about any of that?